Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In his new book, The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource, MSNBC host Chris Hayes dives deep into the transformative moment in history that we're in. He argues that attention has become a commodified resource extracted from us in ways we often don't even notice, leaving us more disconnected from ourselves than ever. Hayes offers an examination of how the assault of attention capitalism has reshaped not just our minds, but our politics, our relationships, and the very fabric of society itself. He does believe there is hope, and he lays out a roadmap for how we can reclaim our attention and ultimately our future. Chris Hayes is the Emmy Award-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes and the New York Times bestselling author of A Colony in a Nation and Twilight of the Elites. And it is a great pleasure to welcome to the stage of the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, New York, Chris Hayes, for this week's book show.
How are you?
Very nice to see you.
Hey, guys.
In the book, you talk a lot about the attention economy. Where does Donald Trump fit into that economy?
You know, I think the reason that we are in the situation we're in is because of a, in some ways, strange accident of history, although maybe all huge historical moments are accidents. The particulars of the version of attention capitalism that we exist in have been most relentlessly exploited by this one person because of a deep brokenness within him. Like, there's a kind of key into a lock feature in which, like, his particular almost kind of feral reptilian pathologies managed to unlock something about our age. And what I think he managed to unlock is, as I argue in the book, attention is the world's most important resource. It's the signature resource of our age. Whether it's the most valuable in dollar terms, I think, is debatable. But it's the signature resource of our age in the same way that I think it's fair to say that fossil fuels were the signature resource of the industrial age. And he has an instinct for that and a kind of compass towards that that is essentially unrivaled by anyone else.
You've been writing the book for a couple of years, and it's ready to come out, I believe, in the end of January of 2025, and Donald Trump is elected president. Did you have to go back and change anything?
I didn't. You know, it's funny because I was thinking about this. I delivered the book to the publisher before the election. And I was, well, I was hoping, you'll be shocked to hear, for a Kamala Harris win for a whole bunch of reasons. One tiny one was, like, I don't want to go on book tour and talk about Donald Trump for weeks. That said, I do think that it explains a lot about where we are. And it's funny, there was one part of the book that I worried about in the last round of edits, after I had my last read and I was sort of delivering it and it was going to be the version of the manuscript everyone was going to have, I was like, you know, there's a lot of Elon Musk in this book. Is there too much Elon Musk? Is that going to seem...
Is.
Yes. 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 It's like an eighth grade boy's cologne. It's like you want...
That's right.
Very, very little bits of it. I was like, is there too much Elon Musk? And I decided to keep it all in. I think that what I now realized was that I was recognizing that he was doing something, in some ways a kind of iteration of Trump's play, which is that he too had come to the same kind of feral insight that Trump had about the need for attention and had quite sort of savvily accrued it to himself in order to wield even more power than he had.
You talk about this in the book, and I found it fascinating because sort of the opposite of all this is boredom, right? All these things, our phones and bells and whistles, and we look at it, and God forbid we be in our own thoughts and we're bored. And I noticed this with my nieces and nephews as they were growing up, when the first thing they would say is, oh, I'm bored. And you think, how are you bored? You've got TV, you've got toys, you've got friends, you've got siblings. Us, and yet we want our attention to be focused on something.
To be taken, yeah.
Yes. What is it about us that wants that?
It's such a great and important question. I mean, every parent in this age has had the experience of like, you'll be there and you're like looking at your phone and like your kid comes up and they're like, could I have screen time? You're like, no. Amuse yourselves. And I think, you know, one of the things that the chapter that I wrote in the book on boredom was in some ways one of the most rewarding for a few reasons. One is, I think boredom is an inescapable inheritance of certain conditions of what we would call human civilization. We've got some pretty good evidence that societies of humans that live as hunter-gatherers and outside what we would call like civilization don't experience boredom, like genuinely don't experience it, don't have a, like the Aborigines, for instance, is a great paper I cite in the book, like do not have a word for boredom. They use the English word boredom as a literal import. But that said, as long as people have been in societies recognizably fixed, right, in one place, boredom has stalked humans from the beginning. What's interesting about this, I think, is to distinguish what's a sort of part of the human condition, something that Blaise Pascal writes about in the 17th century and Kierkegaard writes about in the 19th century, which is the difficulty of being trapped with your own thoughts, the kind of restlessness of our own consciousness, the fact that what it means to be human is to live with this little thing inside you, this conscious self that you can never outrun, that's always there. But, and also, the way that certain institutional, social, and technological arrangements exacerbate boredom. So one of the insights that Pascal has is he talks about the king. Imagine a king who has every amusement before him, and if you take an amusement away for even a second, he's like, panicked. And that's all of us today, right? The less time you spend being bored, the more difficult boredom is, the more you come to hate it. I'm sure everyone in this auditorium has had the experience of parking your car in a temporary spot, throwing on the hazards, walking into a coffee shop to go get a cup of coffee, and you realize there's a 3-minute line and you don't have your phone. And there's that, like, there is that nanosecond of panic. You're like, what am I gonna do? Sit here? Like, and everyone, I think, also had that experience growing up where you would sit at the breakfast table with the cereal box and you'd read the back of the cereal box because, like, that was the thing to take your attention. What I think happens is because that demand side, the demand side of the attention problem is so profound and the engineering from the perspective of attention capitalism is so sophisticated, that increasingly we are given a world in which we never for even a second have to be trapped with our own thoughts. And that makes it all the more terrifying and horrible to be trapped with our own thoughts. But spending time alone with our own thoughts is actually pretty important. Nice. I haven't gotten that as an applause line before, but I...
Nice.
I like that. No, I think it's really important. I think it's where insights about ourselves come. It's where brainstorming and creativity come. One of the sort of small little like self-help takeaways I think I have from this book is that everyone should spend a minimum 20, better 30 minutes a day alone with your own thoughts. Yeah, scary, I know. Although I find it's a little like, every time that I ever go on a hike, and you know, we're up in the Hudson Valley, people hike a lot. I always find when I go on a hike for like the first 5 minutes, I'm like, this sucks so much. Like, are we doing this for 2 hours? And then after 5 to 10 minutes, you know, your heart rate sort of settles, and then it's like amazing. And you do enter that flow state. And it's really the same with being alone with your own thoughts. It really is those first few minutes of your rebelling against it. And then you do fall into something that, again, I think has really been taken away from us by the accessibility of this particular suite of technologies.
Chris Hayes is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is The Siren's Call. There's so many facets to this, but one of them is the fact that our attention is focused on the phone or social media or whatever the case may be. Then there are those of us who, many in this room probably, who use social media sparingly, share some pictures of the grandkids, see what's going on with your brother or sister in Cleveland, find out what's going on. But that's a far cry from the influencer, the person who wants your attention, who is looking for your attention. So there's an aspect of this, and I don't know, but it seems as though that is just making many, many more narcissists.
Yeah, I think what we have is, first of all, social attention from strangers is a weird thing. And I can say this with some authority, frankly. We need social attention from others from the moment that we come squalling into the world. It's necessary for our survival. We're exposed to social attention and we learn social attention exclusively in the context of friendships, family, kinship, relationships, bilateral relationships. It's very weird when you start getting social attention at scale from strangers because you're trained on the wrong data set, right? You're trained on it to think of it as feedback from people you love. So if someone on the internet like says you're a jerk or you're wrong, it kind of wounds you in this way as if like someone you love had said that, because that's just what you're used to. And then you sort of get better at it. But we have an entire set of cultural stories and tropes about people that flame out from fame. Too much fame, too quickly, the starlet that ODs, the rock star. And like we all understand at some level that they're driven mad by all the incoming social attention. One of the strange things that we've done is democratize that experience to anyone with a phone. Like the madness of fame can now be yours if you have a phone.
Right.
And not only that, in something that I think is even more perverse, it has shifted the hierarchies of status and social desirability of social attention from strangers. I mean, one way to think about this is, for much of, at least in Anglo-American and European contexts, I'm limiting it to that, show business was like a very like trashy kind of undertaking. Like it was kind of like rough and it was sort of lurid and it was like what not classy people did. And I don't think that's right. Like I used to do theater. I love performing. But what we've done is we've now made that kind of desire for social attention as the kind of peak of a kind of status hierarchy for what everyone should want. And I write in the book that like the pathos of Death of a Salesman, the reason that it's such an incredible play, that it plays all over the world to this day, even though it was written in the late 1940s, early 1950s, is that it's the story of a man whose entire livelihood and self-value is bound up in others' attention that he cannot get. And there's something desperately tragic about it. And when his wife says to her sons, attention must be paid, he's a human being. He can't just be ignored. He can't just die like a dog. Like, attention must be paid to this man. That the attention age has made Willy Lomans of us all. That the status hierarchies of the culture increasingly put everyone on the street as a salesman. That it's the necessary condition. I run into this all the time. I was on vacation with a friend of mine who's an extremely successful guy in finance and private equity. Inordinately successful. And he was saying to me, he's like, yeah, he's like, some people there don't want me to do these like videos on LinkedIn, forward-facing stuff. He's like, I don't really want to do that. And it just cracked me up because like, you're basically at the peak of your game. And now the next thing to do is to make a video on LinkedIn? Like, that's the next step up?
Right.
From being like a super successful private equity dude? And it just made me realize that like, and I'm sure people in the audience, like this is true of like small business owners, right? They're constantly like, how do we get on Instagram and how do we, and so you have this bizarre thing where fundamentally this kind of fool's gold, this synthetic drug that is social attention from strangers has become a kind of dominant societal ethos.
So the fact then that there are the companies that allow these platforms, that create these platforms, that are trying to assist us in getting to as many people as possible, but also to monetize anything they possibly can monetize.
Yep.
And that seems not only a delicate balance, but a dangerous battle.
Yeah, and I think part of what makes it different now, I mean, look, I work in cable news, right? I mean, we're trying to get people's attention. That's why I wrote the book. I think about this all the time. It's what my practice is. The age we live in now is different for a few different reasons. One is the scale is totally unprecedented. Like, ByteDance has 2 billion users. There's no television show that had 2 billion people watching it. Plus, the algorithmic feed is really the first time that we took sort of machine learning and unleashed it on the populace at scale, where it's constantly trying to sort of learn what people will and won't pay attention to. It also completely annihilates human judgment. And I think this is sort of interesting, because at one level, there's something amazing about the annihilation of human judgment, insofar as you discover from the algorithm that there are things that are really fun to watch or grab your attention that you never thought would. Like, for me, I really like carpet cleaning videos.
Just fascinating, aren't they?
They are. They're very relaxing. I swear to God, I'm going to get home tonight late, and I'm going to crawl into bed with a carpet cleaning video. Well, my wife will be asleep. For people that don't know, it's a genre of video in which, like, this is not that complicated, so bear with me. There's a carpet that's really dirty, and then it gets cleaned. And you watch it get cleaned, and then in the end, it's very clean. What's interesting about the carpet cleaning video genre, which has like tens of millions of likes and views on YouTube, is that you probably wouldn't have been able to walk into like an NBC or CBS pitch meeting 30 years ago and been like, I got a great idea for a show. Starts off dirty. But it turns out that, like, actually there's all sorts of stuff that is popular online that's been sort of discovered by the algorithm. And in that way, there's something kind of fascinating, almost sublime about this, that we've pushed past the boundaries of the gatekeepers. But the negative part of this is that when you entirely remove human judgment and you have this sort of Hobbesian war of all against all in the context of these platforms, which are running essentially attentional markets, right? These very sophisticated and very rapid markets for people's attention, that there is no goal other than getting people's attention. Attention becomes the end in of itself. And so the way attention works in our lives is as a means to some end. So like in the context of news, like I have to get people's attention, but then I want to get their attention so that I can like inform them. Or if you're a creator with some vision for a TV show or a movie, like you have some kind of artistic vision that you're trying to bring forth. In the context of the algorithm, it's just attention for attention's sake. And so you get this very weird flattening when you ask people where they get their news, particularly people 30 and under. Like they basically all say the platforms, the internet. And if you're getting your news from the platforms, it's just like carpet cleaning video, conventionally attractive woman dancing to a TikTok song, some clip of a stand-up thing, something about the Illuminati and Jeffrey Epstein, another carpet cleaning video, the vaccines cause cancer. Like, it's all like, it's just there. There's nothing marking off things as having some other purpose or other goal or other ethos other than to get your attention. And I think it's wildly dangerous for public life.
This Dr. Pimple Popper.
That? I don't get that one. That's
right.
Not for me.
So
that
you
not
have, it started off very benign. And now, I swear to God, she's doing like basketball.
Abscesses.
Yeah, basketball-sized tumors. And so you keep on trying to top yourself.
That's exactly right.
Bigger, 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 bigger.
It's funny to think of these genres that are purely algorithmically derived.
Yes.
Because I think one of the things that I think is worth thinking about is the construction of demand. So here's an example. In the United States, there is not a lot of demand for international news. sometimes when you tell people like in a crowd like this, they're like, that's not true. I watch international news. It's like, you're at a book talk on a Saturday night. Okay, you guys read international news.
And we love you for it, by the way. You
that's
are
great.
Our audience.
We love it. But like, let's just think about how many people there are in this country, okay? There is relatively weak demand for international news, and anyone that's ever worked in journalism, on the back end of any publication, you can see it. You know, stories about international news, like, they do worse. Now, the reason I'm talking about international news, and the reason I'm talking about it in this context of the construction of demand is this. It's not a law of human news consumption that people are not interested in international news. There are many societies in which people really are. Why is international news not capture people's attention in the U.S.? And to what degree is attentional demand exogenous? And to what degree is it cultivated through institutions and habits over time? Part of what I'm trying to say in the book is that, like, the market incentives and the technologies we have are capable of cultivating different forms of appetites, different kinds of attention, because ourselves are at war with each other. We don't have one self. We you know, there's the self that wants to read the three novels you brought on vacation. There's a self that, like, scrolls on Instagram. And which one's the real you? Well, in some revealed preference sense, maybe it's the one that scrolls, but I sort of reject that. Like, I think we all have different selves. Political democracies are like this. You know, different appetites and habits can be cultivated. I think there's an American self that is extremely skeptical of and even kind of nasty towards immigrants. And I think there's an American self that's incredibly welcoming of immigrants. And there's a question about which of these appetites we're cultivating.
In the last chapter of the book, toward the end of the book, when you try to give us some hope.
I do my best.
When you say we're not destined to have the current form of attention capitalism forever, one of the examples you're given, I would just like to read this. The dream of connection that tech companies have marketed and promised, you're talking about, and you bring up Facebook. Their entire value proposition for years has been some version of easily see pictures of your grandkids, and for a while it worked before it fell victim to the market logic of spam and identification, which is a word you use in the book. But in the same way that you can hang out with your friends at a public park or at a beach instead of at a restaurant or a mall, we should have non-commercial options for this kind of connection. And this isn't some pie-in-the-sky hypothetical. Right now, one of the fastest-growing and most widely used messaging groups in the world is the end-to-end encrypted app Signal. Which is developed and distributed by a nonprofit 501c3. As a nonprofit, their website tells users we don't have investors or profit-minded board members knocking during hard times, urging us to sacrifice a little privacy in the name of hitting growth and monetary targets. But look how we've been using it.
Every tool can be used for good and bad ends. You know, there's different uses of an ice pick. But I do think Signal's a really, it's funny that it's become, you know, such a, it's also funny that Trump clearly doesn't understand it at all. He keeps saying, like, he keeps saying, he said this like two or three times, that like someone was on the line, he says. Like, it was like one of those 1980s party lines that they were like all talking on, and there's just, it is funny to see the Signal stuff blow up, and Signal really is unique in many ways in the landscape. And one of the points that I'm making in that section is that it's very weird, actually, if you take a step back and think about it, that the entirety of our digital lives is commercial. Our whole physical lives isn't commercial. Like, why should all of our digital lives be totally commercial? And what's also interesting about it, and what makes it even weirder, is that we actually already went through a battle like this. So in the 1990s, the earliest version of the mass internet was entirely commercial, and it was controlled by three companies, Prodigy, CompuServe, and AOL. They were so-called walled garden models in which you paid them to access the internet, and they were platforms that controlled everything within it. That model was defeated by what came to be known as the open internet. And the idea of the open internet was a non-commercial, civic, cooperatively constructed and maintained space in which kind of anyone could sort of hang up a shingle at a website and you could just put it into your URL and go there. That open internet has then been destroyed by the platforms. But, and this is a really important point, it's not like it's not technically feasible to build another one. It's still there, right? Some people associated with places like Blue Sky, I think, are trying to sort of revive an open internet. The people around Signal really believe in an open internet. The folks at Wikipedia who are sort of manning the last, like, institutions of the open internet. But it's not like, one of the things I think we tend to do is conflate tech with the current market institutions that tech is embedded in. But, like, there can be different ways that you can see pictures of your grandkids that aren't Facebook. Like, believe me, we do have the technology for this. And one of the sort of exciting challenges, I think, in this era is to go out and build that stuff.
And to realize that we're protecting ourselves while using what is available to us.
Yes, and to build spaces online where the primary driver isn't to extract and monetize our attention as the only model for growth and revenue.
Chris Hayes' new book is The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. It is published by Penguin Press. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. In the meantime, a big cheer for our guest, Chris Hayes. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.